trust in the media hasn't exactly been strong for a long, long time in this country. In fact, a Gallup poll out a year ago had confidence in the media to new lows, all-time low of 40%. Last week's protests at MU raised the issue again as students shut out the media at one point, raising all kinds of questions about First Amendment rights and access to public spaces. Joining us here to talk about it are Ryan Thomas. He's an assistant professor of journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism at MU. And Ryan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also here are Frank Morris. He's KCUR's national correspondent and senior editor. Frank, good to have you.
Hi, Steve.
And Janelle Belmas. She's an associate professor at KU's School of Journalism. Janelle, nice to have you, too.
Thank you.
Ryan, why did MU students react the way they did at the protest where at one point they tried to shut out the media? What was going on there?
Well, I think there's a number of factors, both long-term and short-term, in terms of the day itself. In the long-term, it's been a pretty tense semester in terms of dealing with students feeling unsafe on campus, patterns of racism, complaints about the lack of faculty of color. We've had issues with graduate student health insurance, Planned Parenthood, and broad-based dissatisfaction with university leadership that sort of provides a lot of context for the day's events. And then on the day, you've got an unfamiliar and high-tense, high-pressure situation for many students, intense media pressure, and then the sudden release of emotion and swarm of people when Wolf's resignation was announced. I think it just all those things sort of spilt over on the day.
Well, Ryan, did there wind up being some regret over all this? I mean, after all, the way the media was treated became the story for a day or two there instead of what the protests originally were all about.
I think that is the case. It became a First Amendment story. It became a story about journalists. So what we end up with is journalism about journalism rather than being about the issues, which is always regrettable. I think it sort of took the focus off the issues, and I think there's lessons to be learned from the activist side in terms of media relations.
Well, Frank, you were over there. What did you experience in terms of, you know, how the protesters reacted to you as a reporter? And what were your journalistic colleagues saying about the treatment that you guys wound up receiving?
Well, I mean, it was just kind of a perplexing situation. If you walk up to a group of protesters and say, you know, hey, can I ask you about this? No, you can't. Is there anyone over there that I can speak with? No, there's nobody here.
Really?
You know, you need to send an email or, you know, tweet to somebody. You know, it was odd to get that kind of hostility, honestly, from protesters that are out there protesting in a public space, and then they kept expanding the area where you weren't supposed to be. You know, at first it was just around the tents, which you can kind of see they give people a little bit of space, but then they kept expanding arbitrarily and saying, no, you have to get out of here. You have to leave. You know, you need to delete that audio that you gathered in our space. And it was just bizarre, really. It was very, very, you know, everybody's on a deadline. And so it is highly annoying to be blocked like that from people who that you think it's going to be the easy part of your story to talk to those folks.
Well, Frank Morris, you've covered other protests before. I'm thinking about Ferguson most particularly. Have you experienced anything like this before?
Well, I mean, in Ferguson, it was a little different. There was a level of hostility among some people. I mean, it was all over the shop. Your response to the protesters there. I told people over and over again, look, I've been doing this for more than 20 years. I've never been shut out like this except by, you know, a corporation or, you know, sometimes you see this with kind of, you know, xenophobic country folks. You go out there, you know, and you seem to be a foreigner and, you know, maybe the enemy and certainly suspect. That's exactly the same kind, which, again, was perplexing to me to get this from a bunch of college students who are protesting to for them to act just like, you know, honestly, really uneducated rednecks who are, you know, suspicious, you know, of the media. It was really bizarre.
And in theory, they wanted this story out, right? This was, you were doing the work that they sort of wanted you to do, Frank.
Well, I mean, that's the assumption. If somebody sets up on a public space and they're you know, eventually, you know, later in the day, in the morning, celebrating their big victory that they won, which was, you know, just sort of a smashing turn of events for that little movement, you would think, I mean, you assume they want to talk with you. That's why they're there, but it wasn't why they were there. And there was a blanket and just repeated over and over again, don't talk to him, don't talk to the media, get out of here.
Wow.
You know, and so it was just, it was, you know, I didn't think it was going to be a story. Because again, you know, a story about how you have to do your job, and also, you know, public space. Who owns the public space? But it really was perplexing and really aggravating.
Janelle Belmis, from your vantage point over at KU in Lawrence, you know, how surprised were you to see students reacting in the way they did?
Somewhat surprised. Again, as he just said, the idea with students being out there protesting is that they want their message to get out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you read about the ways in which the reporters, both student and professional, were treated by this group of people, it's kind of appalling. I'm sort of appalled, too, that when the assistant professor of communication tried to shut people down. To me, that is not what we want to teach our journalism students. It's not what we want to teach our college students.
Well, that was my next question. Melissa Glick, who sort of led the charge in some ways to steer the media away, she was a communications professor herself. And again, that caught me off guard, too.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole idea of, well, for one thing, a professor being there is, I mean, I applaud that. I applaud professors when they get into activist situations with their students, because it shows that they have a genuine understanding and support for what the students are asking for. So I don't have any trouble with her being at this protest. What I have trouble with is her shutting out the reporters, you know, basically saying, I need some muscle over here to help remove these pesky reporters. And, you know, if she doesn't understand the First Amendment, that is a big issue. That is a huge issue. Those reporters had a right to be there. They had a right to ask the participants in the rally for their opinions, had a right to be in the same public space as they did.
Right. Frank?
Oh, yeah. She was the one who actually asked me to, or told me to, delete my audio.
Oh, Melissa did.
Yeah, she did. Yeah,
no
That's
kidding.
Yeah, I was face to face with her several times over the course of the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan, I'm wondering if another set of protests were to spring up a week from now, if the media would experience the same kind of reaction, or have students and faculty learned something from this last experience?
I like to think that the latter has happened, and there was a tweet posted from the Concerned Students 1950 group the following day that media were welcome or would be welcome, that the media have a First Amendment right to report on this kind of information and to be there. I think it is a learning curve, a very steep learning curve for a lot of people on this campus. It's sort of revealed that First Amendment understanding is not as robust as we would have hoped, perhaps. But I'd like to think that there are some lessons that have been drawn.
You know, I'm wondering, Ryan, we're talking here about the students. Let's flip the conversation and look at the media a little bit here. How well, in your view, has the media done when it comes to covering, I'm thinking about the deeper ramifications of this story. The protests, in a sense, are the easy story here, but there's a deeper story, which is the systemic racism that so many students say they've experienced over there in Columbia. Is that being looked at?
Well, I think our local journalism has done a terrific job in terms of really deep, thorough, contextual reporting. A lot of the national outlets, I would say, not so much. It becomes very much focused on individual incidents. We had a swastika in feces in a dormitory here, and that became sort of the tagline, the poop swastika, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the sort of the driving focus of a lot of the coverage. And that's not to say it was all problematic. I think the New York Times did an excellent piece on it. The Washington Post, I think, has done an excellent piece. But some of the television networks have not covered themselves in glory in terms of how they've covered it, because it hasn't linked it to the issues that the protests are about, and also the wider issues on this campus about graduate student labor rights, Planned Parenthood. There's a whole lot of context. So, for example, when the chancellor resigned, the chancellor's resignation was not... It was linked to these protests only in the sense that this provided an occasion for it. But a lot of us on this campus knew that there's been wide dissatisfaction with the chancellor over a number of issues, and this was sort of the tipping point. So that kind of context got lost a little bit.
Frank, what's your sense of how the media has done covering the deeper angles of this story?
Well, I mean, you know, you, again, the Post and the Times kind of were in early on this story, and they did do some very nice stuff. I felt like NPR did a pretty credible job, sent a guy from Code Switch in who did a little bit more of the, you know, the sort of contextual background. But a lot of people, you know, they just came in once the football strike was threatened. The whole national media poured in, and they just kind of hit the story with the high points.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you only have a very limited amount of time to do that, well, then you do. You have like your three or four incidents that you tick off, and that and say, well, this is what got things rolling. So I don't know. I guess you have to report on what the news of the day is, if you're in that situation.
So. Janelle, what about the obligation of the media to run deeper with this thing?
Well, I can tell you that I'm looking right now at my own student's campus newspaper, the Daily Kansan, and their Monday edition was talking about the, there was a town hall meeting last week with the chancellor and a bunch of students. Our chancellor is a woman of color, Bernadette Gray Little. She was there listening and promoting discussions about racism on campus. And I think that the closer the media gets to covering the students at home, the better off we are, in the sense of providing the students with context and the people, you know, who are concerned about the students. But that's the faculty, that's their parents, that's the state in general, concerned about the students. The more in depth we get from, say, the Kansas City Star or other local media organizations, I think the better off we are. And I think there is an obligation, particularly for our state here, you know, Missouri and mm-hmm. Kansas, to keep a close eye on this. I mean, I heard mentioned earlier about my own student senate calling for the ousting of some of its top leadership because of our version of the 1950 protesters, which is the Rock Chalk Invisible Hawk
right.
group of kids.
Right.
And, you know, I think that there's a lot that this has brought out some students who might otherwise be apathetic to student government and happenings around campus and in the greater community. So in a sense, if the conversation does go in a direction that is productive rather than simply mudslinging, I think it has a potential really to have a greater impact. I'm not sure that so far the local media has done as good of a job as I would have liked to have seen.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do quite a bit of digging to get enough information just to talk to you guys. My colleague, John Peters, who's speaking with another part of your organization, wrote a really nice Columbia Journalism Review article discussing some of the issues facing the media and links in there to a number of good stories from the New York Times, the LA Times, and mm-hmm. a few other organizations.
We're talking about the media and its proper role in society, how well it did covering the MU protests last week. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Josh from the Waldo neighborhood. Josh, good morning.
Good morning. I listen all the time, but I have to call in on this one.
Sure.
I was a member of the Big 12 Council on Black Student Government, so clearly I went to a Big 12 school. And these issues have been going on at MU for quite some time, and the media chooses to portray what they want to portray. Now, I understand that as journalists, you all want to get out there and do your job and get the message out. But actually, as young African-Americans, we do not trust you all, because you can say one thing and we tell you one thing, and then it gets turned around. It's portrayed a completely different way. So I agree with the students at Mizzou, because they have to have the ability to control the message that they want presented, not the one that you all perceive needs to be out there.
Yeah. Josh, give me an example of what you're talking about. Can you come up with one?
Oh, yeah. At Kansas State University in 2003, there was an issue with the advisor of the student newspaper. And there were comments that were said, and we had a lot of media attention. But it wasn't the media attention that we wanted. It was more so saying that we needed to toughen up and we needed to have thicker skin, and this wasn't an issue. I don't know why this is a problem. If that's what the media is portraying out there, there are people who are going to buy that hook, line, and sinker, regardless of if it's actually a fact of why we're upset. Like, this has been going on for too long, and clearly the media is not portraying the struggle and what it feels like to be a minority student on a predominantly white campus. So if you all don't want to do it the way that we want our word portrayed to the world, then we just won't talk to you, and we'll work on our own campus and get the stuff done ourselves, because screaming to Fox or the local newspaper or whoever it may be isn't getting the job done.
Right. Josh, I'm really glad you called in. Ryan, I'm wondering if you could react to what Josh is saying here.
Well, you started the show by talking about how trust in the media is falling, and there's a couple of things that the research tells us about that, how trust falls year on year. There's a trend here, but there's two particular trends that polling has found, that trust among in the media is particularly chronic amongst young people, and also particularly chronic amongst ethnic minorities who don't feel, and for a long time have not felt, that their communities and the issues that matter to their communities cover them at all, but when they are covered in an accurate manner.
Frank, what do you think? Frank Morris from KCUR.
Yeah, another thing I think is that, you know, with the advent of social media, you don't need the media as much. You don't need that microphone. And people get used to controlling their own media. So why turn it over to a third party mm-hmm. guy that you don't know mm-hmm. whose job is to synthesize what you're saying with what other people are saying and present something that they think is a clear picture of the whole thing that's going on, when you can just dictate your own social media, you know, message and have it be exactly what you want to say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's part of the issue too.
Josh, are you still there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. What do you make of what Frank just said?
I think that's right on point. In 2004, we didn't have the ability to hop on Facebook, Twitter, or IG and say, "Hey, this is what's going on my campus." We had to actually get on the phone and text people or call folks. And then we had to muster support that way. Now you can start a campaign and have 50,000 likes in an hour and just brought the awareness to what's going on in your campus without having this third-party distortion. And if we say we don't want to talk to you, it's because we want to be our own publicists. We want to put our message out there the way mm-hmm. we want it. And we don't need you anymore, honestly.
Yeah. Josh, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
And I'm glad you guys did the show.
You bet. Bye-bye. Let's go to Neil from Independence. Neil, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the media. Good morning. You there, Neil? Okay. I'm wondering if the treatment of reporters last week is indicative of how Americans feel about journalists in general, Janelle. And how do Americans view journalists these days? What are you seeing out there?
Well, we did research. I come from Cal State Fullerton, and I did some research on, it was actually about voting, but we did some research looking at how the students perceived media organizations by asking them to choose words from a dichotomy. So, for example, we would say the media is unbiased or biased, fair, unfair, clear, unclear. And overwhelmingly, as Ryan suggested, the research was borne out, our research bore out the ongoing notion that people don't think the media is trustworthy. And, you know, trust is what that's one of our stocks in trade, right? That's what mm-hmm. we trade on. And so the ever-declining numbers in demonstration of trust indicates to us maybe that we're not as necessary as once we were. I think Josh had a really good point. They don't need, no student organization needs coverage anymore. But, you know, going back to what he said, I also think that he's in a really sad catch. He and other students in his situation are in a catch-22, because if they're not controlling their own message and they're blocking people from getting out a message, that makes a suggestion that maybe they have no message and that they're there for another reason. I don't think that's true in this case. I think there is a good message, and I think it needs to be out there. But my concern is that they may be going around about it the wrong way.
Yeah,
it would be better for them to kind of point to where the news could be gotten, instead of just saying, you know, reporters out of here, the right to be let alone.
Sure.
I mean, yes, there is somewhat of a right for that, but not if you're standing in a public space. You're asking for people to come by and ask questions. And if, you know, if you're not, you might as well be in somebody's basement.
Well, Ryan Thomas from MU, you sort of do wonder, based on what Frank just said, based on our caller, Josh, if there's a growing segment of the American population that is used to controlling its own message through Facebook and Twitter, you wonder what the future of the media is.
Well, that that is certainly alarming. I think that there certainly is a place for the media. I mean, one of the things that is I should, you know, caveat some of the stuff about this public opinion polling, is that this term, the media, is a pretty broad concept, right?
Yes.
I mean, the media could mean several things. And when one of the things the research is starting to indicate is that when you name specific news organizations, particularly specific local news organizations, trust tends to go up. So the media itself is a pretty unsophisticated sort of measure, unless you sort of parse it out a little bit. But also, I think, you know, within the sort of political culture at large, there is the tendency to treat the media as a sort of political football to sort of win partisan favor and suggest that, you know, the mainstream media are biased and this and that, even though there's no social scientific evidence that suggests that. And you're also swimming against audience fragmentation, a more polarized society, and greater demand for partisan media and infotainment. So it is a complex situation.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think there's room for good, trustworthy public interest reporting.
You know, Janelle, before we close this conversation, I want to jump back to you. Can you explain to our listeners the rights of journalists when they cover a public event like the protests over at MU? What can they do? What can't they do?
Well, they are permitted to be in a public space just like everyone else. They are permitted to record in that public space, whether that's audio, video, or both. They are you know, as long as they're standing on public property, they are permitted to photograph even into private property, as long as you can see it from the sidewalk or the street where you are. There may be rules. I mean, there are time, place, and manner rules. You can't have maybe too loud of a sound truck or what have you. But police are not permitted to confiscate your equipment. They're not permitted. No one is permitted to demand. Well, they're permitted to demand, but you can say, no, I'm not going to delete my recordings. I'm not going to delete the pictures that I've taken. And, you know, if the police do so, they are potentially committing a felony act. But on the other side, they cannot do anything that a normal person could not him or herself do in that area. In other words, anyone can record in any setting. But if you are causing a disruption, if you are not peaceably assembling, the police or other organizations have the right to come in and tell you to stop. I was just discussing again with my colleague John a coverage at the Denver convention of the Democrats a few years ago where there were people standing outside the door filming who went in and went out, and that upset people. And interestingly, the police officer pushed the reporter into the road and then cited him for blocking traffic. So he knew he had a right to be there. They were not a disruption. He was not, you know, getting in anyone's way, not interfering, not impeding. And, you know, in general, a reporter has the right to do all of that as well as record. But again, so can anyone else.
Let me go back to some phone calls here. Michael from Kansas City, Kansas. Michael, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I like to say the earlier caller, Josh, was there. I like to reinforce the same message. The message gets lost. Whatever the incident is, it becomes a more like a media rating issue. They look at that issue, how they can increase their rating. They portray that as a part of their economical aspect. They look into an economical aspect, that what kind of best rating they can get out of this one. And in the process, the message completely gets lost, and then sometimes it's just the other way around.
Michael, thank you. Frank Morris, you want to respond to that? Is the media always out for ratings?
No, I think, you know, at least from an NPR perspective, the media, you know, is trying to tell the story. They're trying to tell it in an interesting way, though. I mean, that's part of the deal, is you have to make it interesting. So, you know, I think that there is a, you know, you do kind of gravitate toward the more, you know, splashy stuff. But I don't think that ratings is always top of mind for people.
Okay, let me go to some more phone calls here. Let me go to Dan from Kansas City, Missouri. Dan, good morning.
Hi. For the sake of brevity, I'll just keep it to this. I have found that the news will break a story, and they may factually be correct, but then they don't follow up later, leaving a very incomplete story, which leaves a highly biased view of what actually occurred. In the past, you used to have investigative reporters who would give you a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the facts from both sides of the view, so that you could then make an opinion of your own formed on those facts. I don't see any of that occurring now, and I have no trust for the press, and I used to be a big supporter, so I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, Dan, thank you. Ryan Thomas, the lack of follow-up is a frequent criticism of mainstream media.
Oh, absolutely, and what the research shows is when people are probed for why they distrust the media is one of those. That's one of the reasons. It's usually on quality grounds, and lack of follow up, lack of context is one such issue.
Okay, Neil from Independence. Neil, you're on the show.
Yes, real quickly, I think it's the media that is sometimes shapes our opinion of the media. I believe it was in 1986 they created the soundbite. And so our attention span is really brief, and to get into depth on some of these things, really it's hard to do with the way it's presented. There was a show on PBS last night where Walter Cronkite was the quintessential most trusted person in the world. He broke the Kennedy assassination, but it showed where he held back and held back and held back till he knew for certain that Kennedy had died before he put the word out. And there's a lot of that where you get that message out or that soundbite out there, and we don't know whether the quality is there or not.
Neil, thank you. Janelle, do you have just a quick comment in response?
I think he's absolutely right. I think that the 365, 24-hour-a-day news cycle makes the idea of breaking news so much more important, and sometimes quality does suffer in the quest to be the first out there with it.
Well, that was a good conversation. I learned something from it, and I've been doing this stuff for a long time. Ryan Thomas from MU, Janelle Belmas from KU, the KU School of Journalism, and Frank Morris, KCUR's national correspondent and senior editor. Thank you all for a very good conversation.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks for my invitation.
Thank you.